Geneva College, Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania, Wednesday afternoon, February 28, 1973. Bible 310, Comparative Religion, continuing the study of later Hinduism and taking up the orthodox systems of Hindu philosophy. Let us look to God in prayer. O Lord God, our Heavenly Father, it is you who has made us for yourself and who has loved us and given us the capacity to know and love you. We pray that we may live to the full of our potential in Christ, that we may be transformed to his likeness, and that we may have the joy and the freedom that comes from knowing Jesus Christ in a vital and personal way. Bless each one of us according to our needs. Bless this class period. And as we study that which is deviant from the truth, may we value the truth more highly and see it more clearly. Bless any who are in special trouble or faced with problems or anxiety. We ask for Christ's sake. Amen. Now, the point where we were a little bit ahead of schedule even, was considering this book, the Bhagavad Gita. This is a classic that has had influence in India comparable to Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress or even maybe to the Bible in the Western countries. Only rivaled by the Rig Veda. And the Rig Veda they pay lip service to and the Bhagavad Gita they live by. And quite a remarkable book. Dr. Goss says a tremendous influence on countless people for more than 1,000 years. This is a form of the way of devotion, and it is devotion to Krishna, who is an avatar or an incarnation of Vishnu, the preserver. Now, when we get a little further, you'll see the great triad of the gods. India has hundreds of gods and goddesses, but three of them have sort of emerged at the top of the pile: Brahma, the creator, Shiva the destroyer, and Vishnu the preserver. And these have sort of absorbed the all names and qualities of numerous others, at least in many people's thinking. And Krishna is an avatar or an incarnation at one time in this world of Vishnu the preserver, one of the three greatest gods of India. And the book, as I pointed out last time, but there are some that weren't here, I think I'll review this very shortly, briefly here, is a form of devotion to Vishnu, therefore, or Krishna, his incarnation. And a young man named Arjuna is drafted to serve in the army of a little kingdom in India. He hesitates to serve because the war is going to be against the neighboring kingdom where a lot of his cousins live, and he'll have to fight them, and maybe they'll kill him, maybe he'll kill them. And he's seriously considering going AWOL to some different place. But as he is pondering this and sort of agonizing over this decision, his chariot driver turns out to be Krishna in disguised human form. And Krishna talks him into going ahead to serve in the war and tells him that the death of the body is unimportant, that these people will have another life. They've had countless lives before. They just have a little temporary one now. They'll have countless more later. And therefore, you haven't really done them any serious or permanent harm when you stick a sword through their middle and they drop dead. After all, this is only one little phase of the endless long cycle of reincarnation. And Arjuna is finally, let's say, talked into military service and he goes ahead in the war. Now, I read you a quote or two, but the bell rang and I didn't finish it. Arjuna says, I don't know if it'd be better for me to get killed or for me to kill them. Maybe it'd be better for them to kill me than for me to kill them. Is how he feels about it. He's a conscientious objector, but not to all wars. Conscientious, a selective conscientious objector to this particular war. And he feels that strongly about it. And Krishna replies to him, you have grieved over those for whom grief is unmeet. Wait a minute. Arjuna, please. How can I contend in the strife with my arrows against Bhishma and Drona, who are worthy of my reverence? It were better to live by beggary in this world than to kill such noble masters. Were I to slay my masters, all I should enjoy here of wealth and desires would be stained by blood. We know not which is better for us, that we should overcome them or they should overcome us. My soul stricken with unmanliness, my mind all unsure of the law, I implore thee, O Krishna, tell me clearly, what will be the better way? I am thy disciple, teach me, to and come to thee for refuge. I can see no way to cast off my sorrow that withers my limbs, no, not though I win wide lordship without rival on earth, and even to lordship over the gods. Now, Krishna replies, you have grieved over those for whom grief is unmeet, though you speak words of understanding. For the truly learned grieve not for the dead nor for the living. Never have I not been, never have you not been. Never have these princes of men not been, and never shall the time come when all of us shall not still be. As the tenant soul goes through childhood and manhood and old age in this body, so does it pass to other bodies. Transmigration. He who thinks himself to be a slayer and he who thinks himself to be slain are both without discernment. The soul slays not, neither is it slain. It is never born and never dies. Nor may it, being in being, descending to non-being. This unborn, everlasting, abiding ancient is not slain when the body is slain. Knowing this soul to be imperishable, everlasting, unborn, and changeless, how can you think, O Arjuna, to slay it or to make it slain? As a man lays aside outworn garments and takes others that are new, so the body dweller puts away outworn bodies and goes to others that are new. Weapons cannot pierce it. Fires cannot burn it, waters cannot wet it, winds cannot dry it. Not to be pierced is this, not to be burned, not to be wetted, nor likewise to be dried. Everlasting is this, dwelling in all things, firm, motionless, everlasting. Even though you believe that must pass everlastingly through birth and everlastingly through death, nevertheless, so strong of arm, you should not grieve thus. For to that which is born, the coming of death is certain. And to that which is dead, the coming of new birth is certain. Therefore, grieve not over the inevitable. All born things are in their beginnings unshown, in their midway states are shown, and in their endings are unshown again. What lament should there be for this? Looking likewise on your own law, you should not be dismayed. For to a noble warrior, there is nothing higher than a righteous war. Happy the noble warriors who find such a war coming unsought to them as an open door to paradise. Now, you may recall, Dr. North says this book, in spite of its extreme popularity in India, is shot through with logical inconsistencies. You see, he starts to talk here about paradise, and this is not the same thing as nirvana. And there are inconsistencies that are unresolved in this book. Doesn't bother them. If you fall in battle, you win paradise. If you conquer, you have the joys of the earth. Therefore, rise up resolute for the fray, holding yourself with the same indifference to pleasure and to pain, the gain and the loss, the conquest and defeat. Make yourself ready for the fight, and this way you incur no stain of sin. Your reward be in the actions themselves, never in their fruits. So be not moved by the fruits of actions, if not inaction dwell in you. Abiding under the rule of yoga and testing off attachment, perform your actions indifferent alike to gain or loss. Under this rule of the understanding, a man frees himself even in this life from good deeds and ill. Therefore, set yourself to the rule. Skill in actions is the rule. For under the rule of the understanding, wise men abandon the fruits of actions, loose themselves from the fetters of birth, and reach that state which is beyond all ill. When your understanding shall have passed through the turmoil of confusion, then alone you will come to indifference as to the things you have that you hear and have heard. When your understanding shall stand firm and moveless in awareness of the eternal soul, then you will attain the rule. Now, I'm not Krishna, but I can say it more concisely. Just through it. That's the Bhagavad Gita, this amazingly influential and popular book. And it is a part of the way of devotion, reverence for and devotion to Krishna. Now, the way of devotion, as exemplified by this particular book, met the religious needs of people, common folks in India, better than the way of works and the way of knowledge. The way of knowledge was too intellectual and too abstract for the ordinary person to grasp. That was the web of the head. And the way of works was very, cut and dried and ritualistic and formal and sort of technical. And this also did not meet man's emotional needs. Now, the way of devotion, even though it is false from the Christian standpoint, of course, still this does meet the hunger in people's souls and claims at least to satisfy it. So it is no wonder that people have flocked to this in many large numbers. Any questions about the three ways of salvation in India, in modern Hinduism? All right, the six systems of orthodox Hindu philosophy. Now, if you aren't confused yet, I'll see what I can do to get you that way before the end of the period. Or I might say, if you're not confused, you don't understand the situation. Dr. North takes six systems of orthodox Hindu philosophy. You notice how broad-minded they are. You don't have to confine yourself to one. You can pick your choice out of six. Only three of these are treated in the text, the other three only in footnotes. And I'll say right here, if we'll start off on this, we'll skip the ones in the footnotes and take up only the ones in the text. After all, it doesn't take six bullets to shoot the dead, just to see your field do it. So we'll skip the ones in the footnotes and take the ones in the text. Now, the orthodox systems of Hindu philosophy were in the making roughly 1,000 years. This, of course, is a round number. Approximately 500 B.C. to 500 A.D. And back of all these six systems is one assumption that is made. Anybody want to say what it is? Thank you. Well, the one assumption that is held by all of these is, what is it say? Yeah, that the Vedas are inspired and authoritative, the rule of faith and life. Now this, let me point out, can only be lip service to the Vedas, because the basic ideas of the Vedas are in head-on conflict with the basic teachings of these six systems of philosophy. The Vedas, take the Rig Veda, the earliest and most important one, probably about the same time as Homer's Odyssey, and quite similar to it. Dancing with gods and goddesses, it's polytheistic and super polytheistic, they're buzzing all over the place. And it's an unsophisticated, naive, optimistic polytheism. With gods and goddesses, they're a dime a dozen. And these systems of philosophy are overwhelmingly pantheistic. This was the gift of Indian religion, from polytheism to pantheism and from optimism to pessimism. So when these philosophers say they accept the Vedas as their basic standard, this can only be a kind of a formalistic lip service. They can't really mean this because their systems are in head-on conflict with the basic ideas in the Vedas, especially their polytheism. Now then, of these, we will take up these three that are included in the text. Thank you. Just remember that kind of coffee that lets you sleep. Sankhya, and you'll have this remembered. This isn't Sankhya, it's Sankhya. S-A-N-K-H-Y-A. Now, this was a reaction movement against the monism of the Upanishads. Remember the Upanishads? You've got a book, sitting here, teachers. These are monistic idealism. Only Brahma is real, and nothing else is real. Monism. And this is a pretty hard strain on the human mind. monism is hard to continue to believe in. And so there arose this Sankhya system as a reaction against this. It is dualistic and it is atheistic, where the Upanishads are, let's say, monistic and pantheistic. You see, they are, it is an a-cosmic pantheism. There is all God and no world. Instead of this reaction system, Sankhya is a pan-cosmic atheism, all world and no God. Now, it is dualistic and atheistic. It tells us there are two eternal categories of being: matter, or the ordinary world, and soul. And the soul is thought of as an infinite number of individual souls, each independent and eternal. And this is a major difference from standard Hinduism. You see, that thought of the individual souls as an illusion and at best merely a moment in the existence of Brahma. And this system held they are individual, pretty much as we Christians do, individual and independent and immortal. The souls entangled in nature, in this world, have fallen into misery through ignorance of the distinction between soul or spirit and matter. Mary Baker Eddy would have eaten this up. I'm not sure what she did eat it up. Ignorance of the distinction between spirit and matter. Remember my classic little piece of poetry? What is matter? Never mind. What is mind? No matter. These are two irreconcilable categories. You cannot really reduce one to terms of the other. The greatest scholars have attempted them and only cracked their noodle on it. It hasn't been done. But to fail to realize the distinction is the source and cause of our misery. This ignorance binds the soul to bodily processes and to organic natures, causing repeated and repeated and repeated rebirth, reincarnation. And salvation comes through a knowledge of the soul's existential diversity from matter. This is therefore a form of the way of knowledge. And the goal, according to Dr. Noss's previous tradition, is eternal but unconscious individuality. Now, he has told that now. Yes, Mr. Minister. It comes from knowledge, thorough knowledge, of the soul's existential diversity from matter. When you get that through your head, your soul is the opposite of matter, then you're on the right road for salvation. Yeah. Well, this comes by, I'm not sure how they get this. I think this comes by meditation. You gotta think awful hard, though, because on this basis. Now, Dr. Noss, in his previous tradition, said the goal of this process is eternal but unconscious individuality. I would like to ask, first of all, can there be such a thing? Or is that a contradiction in terms? Eternal but unconscious individuality. Can you have an eternal individuality if you are unconscious forever? Well, Mr. Pesaro, does it appeal to you? you know, you're going to sleep through eternity, according to this. Now, I think that's an inherent contradiction in terms, like talking about an honest thief or a truthful liar. It's inherently contradictory. And Dr. Noss has toned this down in the present edition to the following, page 2 and 3. Eternal but unearthly existence and the purity of the spirit. I'm sure this is more acceptable to modern Hindus than the others. Now, that's the first of these systems, Sankhya. The second is yoga, and we already paid a little attention to that the other day. Yoga is a system, and yogi is the fellow who does it. This is also part of the way of knowledge. It is a system of mental discipline and a highly developed mental and psychological technique. And I said the other day, you could easily get the idea that yoga is a form of phys ed. may tell you the acrobatics and contortions that these ladies can perform are simply amazing. They can twist their left leg around to stretch their right ear with it, and all sorts of things. Perfectly amazing what they manage to do. But all of this is not for the sake of athletics or physical development. It is the way of self-discipline to gain control of the mind, and the mind to control the body, so that your body doesn't bother you. You don't get sleepy or hungry or distracted or anything. Your mind is definitely in control, and your body does what you tell it to, and no nonsense about it. That's yoga. And they have postures, breathing exercises, rhythmical repetition of formulas, somewhat similar to Zen Buddhism. And they have 8 steps in this procedure. You take it step by step. But you can sum this up. Yoga is the use of the mind to suppress the mind. The use of the mind to suppress the thinking or emotions of the mind. And the body is to be trained as to aid in this, by all these exercises and so forth and postures. They claim that to reach, now I guess you gotta be a yogi to know what this feels like. They claim to reach the state of pure ecstasy without any thought or any feeling. Again, can you imagine what this would be? A state of pure ecstasy in which you have neither thoughts nor feelings. Now what have you got? You have neither thoughts nor feelings. You got pure ecstasy, that's what you got. And I don't mean to make fun of them, but this is inherently baffling to the Western mind. And I'm sure it baffles a lot of people in India, too. And they claim, ultimately, if you really reach this, as some of them claim to have, that they are liberated from the law of cause and effect. So they will float into a third-story window from outside, sort of breathe in, or breathe out again, and not fall or get hurt. Levitation. They claim that the law of gravity is canceled out. They have overcome this by their attainment of the yoga ideal. These claims are remarkable, but not very many people claim to have reached any such stage as that. Now that's yoga, that's the second. Sankhya, then yoga. The third, far the most important of all these, Vedanta. Vedanta. I'll write up the station. I'm looking at how we work, how we swim in. It's 10 times more important than all the others put together. As far as the claim on the thinking and the people of India is concerned, this is monism with a vengeance. The purest kind of cosmic pantheism. No world and all God. Pantheistic monism from the Upanishad. The Vedanta is a set of writings, part of the Upanishads and certain closing parts of the later Vedas. And the Upanishads are claimed as authority for this notion of cosmic pantheism or pantheistic monism. And Dr. North says advanced Indian thought has usually sided with them. This is the majority belief of educated people that claim to be Hindus. Now this philosophy itself has 3 or 4 forms, and we'll run over a little bit of these. Sankara, S-A-N-K-A-R-A. This is under question 263. Illusionist monism or non-dualism. This is very radical. Nothing exists but the impersonal and indescribable Brahma. All else is pure imagination or illusion. You've got a D grade on the test, think nothing of it. It's imaginary. And so are you, and so is the test taker. And so is the course, and so is the college. All is imaginary. Only Brahma is real. Illusionist monism or non-dualism. The physical universe, the identity of the soul, rebirth, all are illusions such as we meet with in dreams. But, you see, again, this is pretty hard stuff to believe. And this didn't go over with the common local people in India. So the intelligentsia held that this system is for the elite. And the common people have, let's say, the ordinary world to walk around in that is real for them. This is very similar to the transcendental philosophy of Immanuel Kant, to distinguish between the phenomenal realm and the noumenal. The phenomenal realm is the ordinary world that you walk around in, where you can touch and feel things and so on. And the noumenal is the real world of things as they really are, the thing on sich, the thing in itself. And this you can never know, because all knowledge comes through the senses, and the senses process it, so you never can know what the thing in itself is in itself. This is very similar to Kant, although I don't think Kant got it from Hindu sources. I think he gained it up himself. To believe in the reality of the individual soul, the Kant spoke of the phenomenal and the noumenal. And Sankara speaks of the world of Maya and the world of Brahma. Maya is illusion, M-A-Y-A. To believe in the reality of the individual soul is to move in the world of Maya. To have only the lower kind of knowledge. To know that the individual self is really identical with the one and only existing self, Brahmanatman, is to grasp reality and have the highest kind of knowledge. So this is an absolute acosmic pantheism. The man for whom it is named, Sankara, wrote about 800 A.D. Now, there are two others here that are branches of the Vedanta, Ramanuja and Madhva. That goes by very quickly. Ramanuja calls qualified non-dualism. The ultimate reality is personal, not impersonal. This is a compromised view of this. The physical world is a form of this reality, self-manifestation, and this is identified with Vishnu. And it also has a belief in personal immortality. This is an inconsistent form of the Vedanta philosophy. And Madhva, M-A-D-H-V-A, duality, this is also changed by the introduction of elements from Mohammedanism and from Christianity. It is monotheistic rather than pantheistic, and is a minority view. Now, are you sufficiently confused? For us to go on to something this way. Madhva, M-A-D-H-V-A. V, M-A-D-H-V, V like in Victor. M-A, capital M-A-D-H-V-A. This is duality. It's a compromised system of Vedanta, which has been changed by introducing elements from Islam and elements from Christianity. So that it is monotheistic rather than pantheistic. Nearer to the truth, but to make it much less popular in India. All right, any more? Well, Mr. Crawford. Vishnu is one of the three great gods of India, and this is Ramanuja, the second of these forms of Vedanta, qualified non-dualism. It held that the ultimate reality is to be identified with Vishnu, the form of devotion to Vishnu, one of the great gods. Now let's take up something much simpler. Popular Hinduism, 264. We're making pretty short time here, I think.
The relation of the Hindu masses to the philosophical system. Now, I can tell you in less words than Dr. Noss does, the ordinary Hindu, busy scratching around to raise some rice for his hungry wife and kids, is a conformist and not a philosopher. He takes local practices, customs, and beliefs as he finds them, uncritically. It's a day to go to a temple, all right. Everybody's going to a temple, I'll go to a temple too. You say there's three great gods, all right, that's what they say, so I'll believe there's three great gods. And he is a conformist, partly by necessity. Who has time to figure out these heady abstractions? The ordinary person, the masses of the 450 million people of India, have no clear conception of these matters. They follow the beliefs and practices which are traditional in their locality. a syncretism or package deal of animism, fetishism, shamanism, demonolatry, animal worship, devotion to local spirits and godlings, and what have you, all with or without the more respected higher worship of the great gods of the Hindu pantheon. Now, the great triad of the gods, notice this is not a trinity, but a triad. Three gods, Brahma, the creator, Shiva, the destroyer, and Vishnu, the preserver. This Brahma, it has an accent on the second A, and is not the same thing as we were talking about before, when we spoke about Brahma as the only reality. Although spelled the same, except for this little accent mark. This is a particular god among other gods, thought of as the creator, and Shiva the destroyer, and Vishnu the preserver. And these three together are called Trimurti. About 5 years ago, the Indian government brought out a postage stamp that was marked Trimurti. I got three or four of them in the mail. And it had on it a human head with three faces, one facing straight ahead, just one head, see, on one set of shoulders, but three faces, one going straight ahead, one to the left, and one to the right. This is Brahma, Shiva, and Vishnu, all three faces on one head. Yeah, Mr. Coffey.
This is related to Thailand.
Could be, I don't know. I had a student here last year, been in Thailand. He could have told you, but I haven't been there, and I don't know. Anybody here been in Thailand? Well, we got students to do this in Thailand in college, but I don't know for sure. Now, this postage stamp, see, stuck on letters. Some have said this is a satanic parody of the Christian idea of the Trinity. I think not. I doubt it very much that it is. These are regarded in Indian thought as three separate gods. They are tritheists. In this, and they're polytheists beyond that, but these three great gods are three distinct beings, whereas in the Christian idea there is only one God, who however has three centers of consciousness called hypostases in Greek, and in English persons, for want of a better term, three persons in the divine being, but only one God. You see, Trinitarianism, which is basically Christianity, arose among the strictest monotheists of the world, the later Jews. The strictest monotheists the world has ever known, and therefore the major premise of the Christian idea of the Trinity is monotheism. And then it goes on from there and says, although God is only one, there is a complexity in God. He is not a simple unit, but still it is true there is only one God. Muhammad, you know, he said the Christians believe in three gods. This is Muhammad, after Christianity came. His ideas are mixed up. He said they believe in three gods. The Christian Trinity, he said, consists of the Father, the Son, and the Virgin Mary. That's Muhammad. He also said, how could God have a son? God isn't married. And you see, very naive in his criticism of Christianity. He had come up against it only in a very all corrupted and mixed up form. Now, these three in India, the Trimurti, this is not a trinity, it's a triad, three gods side by side, and they have absorbed the identities and functions of, scores and hundreds of local gods. Now, three gods. How can people whose basic philosophy is our cosmic pantheism or complete monism believe in three gods? How can you do it? The answer to this is the common people don't ask questions based on philosophy. They take it like it comes. And the intelligentsia rationalize it away. Now, you could compare this to belief in Santa Claus. The intelligentsia in India say, of course, Rama is the only existing reality. And these three in this triad, Brahma, Shiva, and Vishnu, these are only different ways of thinking about Brahma that is the only existing reality. But to speak of these in this way, it has a value for the common person. Now Santa Claus. I'm not a particular fan of Santa Claus, but we had a fellow that impersonated Santa Claus at the First Beaver Falls RP Church one time, and he got in there, he'd been engaged in community, not a member, in a state of very obvious alcoholic inebriation. And staggered up the aisle and asked some kid, "You've been a good girl this year." Big pillow under his tummy, you know, under his red robe. Now, I wonder, how old do you have to be to quit believing in Santa Claus? Well, Mr. McNulty, you believe in Santa Claus? Did you once? How old were you when you quit? Five? Saw a picture in the paper of a little kid up on the knee of a department store Santa Claus and says, "Santa, do you mean to tell me you never got that letter I sent you?" Now, Santa Claus, I think we could well get along without. It's a form of superstition. And, however, for some children, this does have a kind of a value. You're going to be good because, you know, you better be good, you better be nice. Santa Claus is coming to town. He's made a list and checking it twice. You better be good, you better be nice. Santa Claus is coming to town. It's all baloney, but the kids believe it. So some of them will be good just on account of this. So you could say belief in Santa Claus for the very young, some people can claim, has a value. I think this is nuts, but some people would say belief in Santa Claus has a value. And in the same way in India, the elite intelligentsia who would disdain to believe in three gods say, "Well, all right, these local yokels here, you can't expect them to understand all these things." And for them, it has a value. It expresses something to them, and so they have they get something out of this. And so it's okay for them. Of course, strictly speaking, it isn't true. That's what they would say. And they would rationalize this away in this way and say that these represent three functions of Brahma: creation, destruction, and preservation. Now, of these three, Brahma, the creator, is the least worshipped. He's the one that ought to get all the worship, but he gets the least worship. How many temples in India dedicated to Brahma, the creator? Six. Half a dozen in that great subcontinent with 480 million people. There are hundreds, maybe thousands of temples dedicated to Vishnu and Shiva. Brahma only gets six. You know, this is, like somebody said, you go to church and put a penny in the collection to give God a tip. Just a sort of a doffing your hat a little bit to Brahma here. And you may recall, when we studied three so-called primitive societies, the Beer Whores, the Bhavinda, and the Dieri, that these people believed in a high God who made the world but do not ordinarily worship him. And if questioned why, they say he has nothing to do with us. Why should we worship him? He is far away and he has nothing to do with us. So this is quite similar to that. Now, Shiva is the one that stands for destruction, Brahma for creation, one of the great gods of Asia. You should realize that in tropical and jungle countries, destruction of anything is never very permanent. Shiva stands for destruction, but they hold this is not absolute, that Shiva destroys to make room for something new. Now, Guadalcanal and New Guinea and the Solomon Islands, the U.S. Army and Air Force built concrete airstrips there in the early 1940s during World War II. That's 30 years ago, approximately. These are almost untraceable today. The jungle has reclaimed them, and there's such a growth of weeds over the concrete that you can hardly find out where they were. The Burma Road that was constructed from northern India into western China to carry war supplies to China to fight against Japan. Tremendous feat of engineering, and truck convoys of dozens of trucks went over this every day. Today is almost unlocatable. Nature has claimed it back, in especially the southern part where the climate is warm. And so Shiva is said to destroy, but not out of, malevolent intention, but in order to make room for something new. We had a proverb in the language school I studied in China, Jodi Bo Chi, Shindi Bo Lai. This is literally, if the old doesn't go, the new won't come. Did I say this before? The old doesn't go, the new won't come. You break a dish or a teapot, well, it's broken. So you got an excuse to go out and buy a new one now. And our language teacher said, you fellas in this class can say this about breaking teapots and things like that. But don't any of you that are married say this about your wife. Jodi Bo Chi, Shindi Bo Lai. If the old doesn't go, the new won't come. And this is the idea about Shiva. The old goes and is destroyed, and the Orient and the southern parts of it, the subtropical parts and the hot parts, have more than their share of typhoons and floods and famines and plagues and calamities of all kinds. And this is, Shiva is responsible for this. Now, if we were Hindus, the devastating floods of Pennsylvania caused last summer by Hurricane Agnes, obviously caused by Shiva. Who else? Shiva is mad at West Pittston and Wilkes-Barre and the Wyoming Valley and Williamsport and Harrisburg and other places and sent this flood. This is how they would think of it. But they would also say a lot of slum dwellings were destroyed by the flood and they'll be rebuilt better, so Shiva has cleared it for better construction in the future, you see. Now, Shiva became identified with processes of sex or reproduction in all forms of life, including human life. And further, by further, let's say, transfer of the idea, Shiva came to stand for life itself, pure life force or pure life energy. And I think there's a picture in your book that Shiva is shown dancing on the squirming body of the demon of delusion, with four arms waving in the air, the Ganges River flowing from his hair, and he's also the patron of ascetics and holy men. Now, I confess these images are pictures of gods with four, five, or six arms waving around, and maybe snakes growing out of their hair. Give me the willy willy. I like when you run your thumbnail over a blackboard. They inspire in me the opposite of religious devotion. Quite repulsive as you look at them, but of course they don't think so in India. The demon of delusion, and Shiva is dancing on this with four arms waving around, and the Ganges River, which actually originates in the foothills of the Himalaya Mountains, the Hindu Kush Mountains, is said to flow from the hair of this god Shiva. Now, Shiva has a number of assistants. Question 267, which I'll be ahead here. Shiva's consorts and associates. First place, Shiva is a married person and has a wife. And she has many names, many different ones have been assimilated into one. One name is Durga, the unapproachable. She is the special patroness of a robber caste bearing the intriguing name of Sud. Now, what is a thug? Mrs. Montini, wife of Mr. Montini in our financial aid office, was mugged within three blocks of this college about 5 o'clock one afternoon up there at 35th Street. Came out of a store, and suddenly somebody from behind grabbed her hands over her eyes. And she screamed and had the presence of mind to throw her money into the bushes like that. It was only about $3, but she tossed it into the bushes. When she screamed good and loud, it wasn't even quite dark yet. This all ran. And she was, of course, somewhat emotionally shaken by this experience. Physically shaken, too. And next morning, Mr. Montini and Mrs. Montini went out and searched around there, and they found all that money, except about 3 pennies that they couldn't find, which they gave up honey for. But that's mugging. It's a violent crime, and it's against the law. It happens almost every day somewhere in the Beaver Valley here. You mug somebody to get their money. And the thugs were muggers. Violent assault and battery was their accepted and recognized world and life view. This is the thug. And There's a whole caste of people whose occupation was robbery and, if necessary, of course, homicide. And Durga, one of the wives, or the main wife of Shiva, was the patroness of this group. Now, she had another name, Kali, which means the black one. And as Kali, she uses her four arms like a big divine human spider to destroy her victims, and then she eats them. A very needy lady, if you ask me. And associated with Shiva is Ganesha, the elephant-headed god, and Nandi, the white bull. Now, Shaktism, 268. I don't think you've studied this, but let me ask, is Shaktism shocking? Well, should it be? Shaktism is the worship of Shiva's consort, his lady friend, conceived as forms of his Shakti, or active power displayed in female energy. This is a minor theme in devotion addressed to adoration addressed to Shiva. A distinct subdivision of Hinduism, especially worship Shiva's wife or wives, especially in northeastern India, almost a separate religion. It has left hand and right hand forms. The left hand is a primitive worship of the force of sex passion, uninhibited, absolutely uninhibited. And it has analogs in the Greek mystery religions. The Orphic and Dionysiac mysteries were something like this, pretty raw. And then the right hand was more elegant and refined and somewhat respectable. Now Vishnu, the preserver. Vishnu, the preserver, always regarded as benevolent. Do you ever listen to television and hear commercials? A man from Nationwide, he's on your side. Ever hear that? An insurance company, but the man from Nationwide, he's on your side. Now, Vishnu is on your side. You can count on that. You worship Vishnu, he won't let you down. Shiva can do you dirt, but Vishnu will get you out of it and get you relief. And Vishnu is always friendly, always benevolent, represents the idea of the divine love. If an impersonal being can have love, exhorts influence to cancel out Shiva's destruction. So you could say if Shiva sent the Hurricane Agnes flood, Vishnu prevented it from getting as far as the flood Beaver Falls. It didn't get to this particular area of Pennsylvania. It's sort of working in the opposite way. Now, Shiva also has four arms, and many avatars or reincarnations, commonly regarded as 10, and they claim that Gautama Buddha is an avatar of Vishnu. This, I suggest, is ideological piracy. It's the principle, if you can't lick them, join them. Buddhism was successfully competing with Hinduism, so what do? They come up with this, well, Buddha was reincarnation of this wonderful god Vishnu of ours, the preserver. And so they make Buddhism to be just a sort of a little appendix or a footnote to the way of the three great gods of India. Of these avatars of Vishnu, the greatest are Rama and Krishna. Now the bell's going to ring, but it's an interesting thing, and we'll leave it till next time. The monkey hole versus the cat hole. Does Rama save people by the monkey hole or the cat hole? There was a picture that a photographer won a prize on in New York, and it's been repeated and republished many times, of a policeman holding up traffic on Fifth Avenue, New York, and the whole row of buses and cars and everything held up, while a pussycat carried a kitten in her teeth across the street. And here's the cop holding up the traffic while the kitty gets the kitten across the street. We'll pick this up and see. It has a strange analogy to Christianity. Does God save us by holding on to us, or does he save us by us holding on to him? See you next week, next time.